So first, thanks for coming to Protect Your Sensitive Information with Office 365 DLP. My name's AJ Smith. I'm a senior product marketing manager on the Office marketing team. I focus on DLP. And I've got two of our program managers with us, BJ Whalen and Jack Kabat, who will also be presenting today. And today's session is going to be a general overview of the DLP solution, and we'll also give you some visibility into our roadmap and what's coming. So you'll see a bunch of things that, if you're familiar with DLP today, you've just not seen before. So we definitely want to give you a little bit of insight into what's going on with the solution in Office 365. So before I get into features and functionality and all this great stuff, let me take a step back and let's talk a little bit about why do organizations need DLP? From a show of hands, how many of you have a DLP solution in place today? Regardless of vendor, how many of you have a solution? Okay. Out of curiosity now, how many of you are running Office 365 DLP in your organization? Okay. Now, seems like a good portion of you see value in DLP. When we talk to organizations like yourself, there are three core things we usually hear from them. First is that they are looking to help protect data that is inadvertently leaking from the company. Most data leakage is actually inadvertent, not malicious. We've seen data that says effectively about 58% of users have leaked sensitive data at some point in their career, right? And that's not like, hey, I'm forwarding this out, I'm going to leave the company. It's the, oops, I put in the wrong email address and I sent this to the wrong person type thing. So when we think about our DLP solutions, one of the areas that we focus on is how do we make sure that we help people stop that inadvertent leaking? So how do we give you the tools to make sure that, again, the end users don't inadvertently leak that data outside of the organization or leak it to someone that shouldn't receive it? We also see organizations looking to have protection without inhibiting productivity, right? There's a fine balance that organizations are trying to find. They want to protect the data that's inside the organization, but they also don't want to kill their information workers' productivity, right? So how do they do that? What's the right balance for them? What are the right policies they want to set up? And then lastly, they're looking for guidance for their end users so that they can make the right decisions, right? Because end users don't always know why they're violating policy, right? They're like, well, wait, why can't I send this email message? Why is this document blocked? So how do we give them the guidance to make the right decision before they actually do the thing they're not supposed to do? So when we look at Office 365 DLP, we really focus on how do we help detect, protect, and monitor your sensitive information. And we do this by focusing on three areas. Of course, the detection, we want to help you easily create policies that find sensitive content wherever it resides in Office 365. So be it in Exchange, SharePoint, or OneDrive, we want to be able to help you find that content. And then once you've detected it, you want to protect it. And we do that, of course, by helping you stop the accidental sharing and educate users. And this is effectively done through what we call policy tips. It's a little UI dialog box that tells you why you're violating the policy. So it gives you right in line with that application so you can make a corrective action so that you can continue on with that document. Now, once you've protected the content, you obviously are going to want to monitor it, right? So you need to get visibility into how your data is being protected. And then also you want to take that monitoring or all that information that you have in the reports to also influence your detection. So it's a complete circle, right? Because you may want to refine your policies based on what the reports tell you. Maybe you need to find more unstructured data versus the structured data that you're already finding in your policy. So who do we build DLP for and where do we actually invest? Well, there's really three target personas that we actually kind of think about when we build DLP. First is probably many of you in this room, the IT admin. You're looking for, of course, enterprise protection that you can easily configure according to your company's policies. And those policies are likely written by that compliance or chief security officer or a team of people that says, this is how we're going to protect data. So obviously that compliance officer, that security officer, you know, is super important and says, hey, look, I need to make sure that I've got a great ROI on my solution, but at the same time, I don't want to worry about betting on the cloud and actually not getting that complete solution. So the cloud's got to deliver exactly what I want. It's got to meet my needs. And then last but not least is the information worker, right? All the people that, you know, of course, you're working for. And again, what they're focused on is, look, I understand we need to protect data, but get out of my way of my productivity. I need to get my job done, and I'm willing to help protect information, but please don't stop me from what I'm doing when I need to get something done. So really, these are the three target personas that we focus on. Now, from an engineering perspective, where do we make our investments? So for the rest of the presentation, we're actually going to talk about where we're making our investments right now in making the solution even better. And that's basically in three areas. First is empowering and educating end users. We want to make sure that they have the information they need to help protect the data that you find sensitive inside your organization. Second, how do we give you insights-driven protection for your data? So are there things in the service that we can do to help you easily find data that you can protect and turn it on very quickly? So we'll give you some of the high-level knobs and switches so that you can easily turn on protection if you don't need very sophisticated, you know, protection needs. And the last piece is that sophisticated built-in protection across Office 365 and the extensibility that we can do with partners. So we'll also get into today to talk a little about all the knobs, like a lot more of the knobs and switches that you can use to really fine-tune the DLP policies to match what you need, and then also how do you extend that by other vendors. So we'll actually have a partner come up and talk about how they're taking some of the DLP information we have and bringing it into their solution. So without me continuing to show you slides, what I thought I would do is actually show you a demo of some of the information worker pieces. So let me jump over to my demo machine. Oops. Okay, so I've got a short demo here, and in this scenario, I am Aziz. I am effectively one of the accountants at my company, and I'm working on a project where I need to focus on getting our new travel agency onboarded for our company. We didn't like our previous one, and I've got to get a bunch of information over to them with credit card information and travel information, you know, names and everything else over to this company so they can set up the profiles, because nobody's going to want to have to create their own travel profile, and I've got hundreds of employees. So what I'm actually going to do is I'm going to go email some of the information that I need over to the travel agency company. So I'm just going to use Outlook, just like most people would do. They'd open up an email message. I'm going to email my buddy Barry at AdventureWorks Travel. I'm going to type in a subject of travel profile info. And then I'm going to go ahead and attach my Excel spreadsheet with all my information in it. And then I'm just going to write him a quick note and say, actually, I didn't even get to do that. Because what you've noticed is at the top of the mail message, it now tells me that, hey, you've got a policy tip that says you've got an item that contains 10 or more credit card numbers is being shared with people outside your organization. You should consider removing this or make sure it's okay to actually send this. So the policy is not stopping me from sending it at this point. I can request an override if I want and provide a business justification, or actually say, well, the message actually is not, doesn't have any sensitive information in it. Well, I know it has credit card information, so if I wanted to, I could request an override and say, hey, I have a legitimate business reason to do this, so I'm actually going to go ahead and do it. Now, I'm going to be like, look, you know, as Aziz, I'm like, you know what, I don't want to deal with this. I've got another way. I can just share it out through my OneDrive account, because I've already shared out with some other people, so I can just add Barry to that list. So I'm just going to jump over into my OneDrive account. I've got this document already here. I just need to add Barry to it. So if I hit share, I add in Barry at AdventureWorks Travel. And I go ahead and, as I even try to change the, and say just give him view access, you'll notice the same policy tip shows up. It says, hey, this item contains sensitive information. If I click view policy tip, it gives me the details. You've got credit card information in this file. You shouldn't be sharing this outside the company. Now, as Aziz, I can be like, look, all right, you know what? I can't send this the right way. Maybe I should just, you know, request an exemption and share it through SharePoint, because I can just limit it to Barry. Maybe, you know, so the email might get forwarded around, but I can just share it with Barry here if I really want. Now, if you were to look around, as Aziz, can I go share it some other ways? For example, if you were to even try, like, say, OneDrive. So the OneDrive Universal app that we have gives me the ability to go in, and if I wanted to share this also, it would give me the same policy tip. So we're putting policy tips in multiple locations. So where the user would kind of think of going to actually use the data and actually get access to it, we're trying to pop those policy tips wherever they go. And it's not just on Windows devices. What I can do is even make this show up on an iPad. So let me cut over to my iPad real quick. So I'm running the OneDrive client on an iPad here. If I were to go ahead and want to share this same document again, says, hey, you've got a policy conflict. If I click OK, of course it tells me, yep, this might conflict with the policy in your organization. And if I continue to click on it, it gives me the details that, again, says you've got credit card data in here. So let me do this and jump back to slides real quick and explain very briefly what we're looking to do. So at a super high level, I'm on number 5. Let's jump back to slides here. So again, we're trying to balance user productivity and risk. And this is where those policy tips come in, right? The idea is that we're helping to educate users when they're about to violate policy. We don't want them to actually go ahead and do that violation, so that's why we pop that user experience. And you notice it's in multiple user interfaces. It's in the desktop apps, it's in the web apps, and it's in the mobile apps. And those policy tips can be configured by IT. So IT's got a lot of control of, can I do an override or not? What does that policy tip actually say? As you saw, there's like kind of a custom message that says, like, is this all right? Do you, you make sure it's okay before you send this? All that is customizable by IT. So instead of us kind of talking more about the user experience piece, what I want to do is bring up Jack to show you the actual IT side of this. So how did he actually create the policies that Aziz saw on the device? So with that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just bring up Jack to go ahead and show the IT experience.
Thanks, AJ. Can you hear me?
Nope.
Can you hear me now? Better? All right, so thanks, AJ. This is very exciting to see this kind of rich experiences across mobile, desktop, and web experiences for both SharePoint or document sharing and also mail. But let's see how we actually make this work from an administrator perspective. And just curious from people in the room, how would you guys classify yourselves? Who would be more of a compliance officer where that's more of your role? Could you raise your hands? All right, a few of those. And who would be more of IT pro administrators so that you have to deal with configuring these kinds of things even though you're not trained necessarily in the compliance field? All right, so the majority of you. And that's great to see because this is really how we're also thinking of this, that we need to cater across the personas, and this is what AJ was talking about earlier. All right, so how do you configure all of this stuff? I mean, I talked to a number of you guys, customers, in terms of the configuration of what it would take to configure a system like this. For example, on premises, where you have multiple services, multiple client endpoints, and making just the simple things that AJ showed a minute ago come to life. And then how do you maintain that and keep that in sync as policies change, need to be updated, and then have a single view of that information? It's pretty complicated. So we're trying to make this easier in Office 365 by providing you one place to manage this. And this is Security and Compliance Center, which is what we have on the screen. And those of you who have seen versions of this previously say, well, this looks a little different. There's a little bit of a newer, a facelift on the Protection Center capabilities. But it's much more than this, because what we're really changing is bringing insights right to you. So this is not something that's flat and you needing to discover. The system is actually analyzing content, analyzing user behavior, and providing you recommendations and insights in terms of how you should be protecting. So the first thing we're going to do is just, this is actually a tenant that's been configured, that hasn't had done much configuration. It's kind of the default tenant and very much supports the scenarios AJ just finished doing. So where I'm going to go first is to the jump off the homepage and go to the DLP dashboard. The DLP dashboard, the first thing you see is a set of insights and a set of policies. The insights just show us the policies in place and how they're behaving. And we see we have one policy in place. So let's see what this is. It's the Office 365 default policy, which means this is actually a policy that we place in the system and is on by default for new tenants who get configured. So what does this policy do? Just go ahead and edit the policy. We see that from a locations perspective, the policy is already targeting SharePoint, OneDrive, and Exchange. One place to target all of the places where you share your content from a mail and document perspective with one place to manage it. And let's look a little deeper. What does this policy do? So we can see that up top here that it's pretty simple. It's just looking for credit card information. And what actions does this policy take? Very simple, providing policy tips. So that kind of maps with the experience that AJ just finished showing. And this is something that's pre-configured in your tenant. But this is not where we end. This is just the beginning. So we're going to go exit here and go back to our homepage. In our homepage, what we see is a set of widgets, and these are dynamic that may appear over time as the system learns more about your usage by your users and the data, their habits, how they're sharing information, and what kind of data is flowing. So one of the widgets here is this one, about 10 documents that seem to have been shared with credit card numbers. Let's investigate that a little bit more. So this is actually a wizard that, as you've started using the system, has been analyzing the content and providing insights and giving you feedback that, look, this default policy we have created that only only surfaces policy tips has actually caught end detections over the last 2 weeks. And with this simple wizard, it's giving you ability to say, you know what, instead of just doing policy tips, I actually want to do more than that. I want to provide real protection by actually blocking the communication and allowing my users to override it if they choose so. And this is actually all that is required to achieve the scenarios that AJ was showing you. The default policy through that's enabled in a mode that does not interfere with your business processes but does notify the users. And then simply seeing that that policy is providing you value, interacting with you to tell you the insights it's learned on its application, and simple enablement to now be able to protect. That's pretty easy. So at that point, you would be set up the same way that and have the policies in place across SharePoint, OneDrive, and Exchange to basically inform end users and provide all the scenarios AJ did. But the system continues to analyze usage and continues to gain deeper insights from its operation. And here you see another widget similar to this. This would appear probably about a month or so of operation where you have, and again, it's looking if there's something interesting to find. In this widget, if we look at it, provides a slightly different insight. And it's telling us, look, the green part of the pie is stuff that's already protected by your default policy. But look, there's additional sensitive information that's flowing in your organization that you don't have protection. And again, this is based on insights of what are common types organizations protect of similar size, similar geographies, that's being analyzed as part of the data flows you have and surfacing you as a set of rich insights. Here, we can again easily go ahead and enable these and then expand our policy to new types where we will now protect US-UK passport numbers, and EU debit cards. And through this simple set of steps, you're building a protection capabilities that's really based on your data. Because this wizard and this view is specific to your data. If you didn't have any of this data, you would not be seeing these kinds of wizards coming up and trying to entice you to enable policy protections. All right, so that's that part of the demo. I'm going to go back to slides for a minute. All right, so that was pretty easy to get that kind of protection. And if we look at this a little bit more, we can see what's going on, that there's really a progression of how the system learns and analyzes your usage, the data flowing within your organization, and provides new recommendations that expand the policy protection and grows with you. We start off by on by default, a default set of policies, not very intrusive, then allow you to expand that to deeper protection if you have data that requires so. And finally, on the far side, being able to make you be in the driver's seat in terms of you creating your own policies as you become more familiar and sophisticated as a user. You know, so the built-in system policy is just looking at that in a little bit more detail. First of all, we will only deploy this to tenants who have no DOP at all. Obviously, if you're already a tenant who has configured rules, configured policies, you are past this starting point. But the idea is to provide a set of protection that are built in the system and really a starting point for you to gain control of your protection policies. And it is a non-interfering policy that only notifies users. Then we move on into this notion of recommendations. As the system learns more about you, about your users and their usage, to provide very simple step-by-step activation for workflows, activation workflows, to enable even deeper protections across new types. And we will continue to look at other insights of how you can provide and continue to give you recommendations based on what the system learns of your data. And all this is for helping you to see the gaps in your protection, which you may not be actually aware of. All right, well, that's all great for a relatively, you know, non-sophisticated organizations or organizations who are just getting started and don't know about the capability or may not even be aware of the data. Because it's interesting, I talked to some organizations, large ones, where it's actually an interesting discovery of what data's flowing through their networks, through their what content their users are sharing, which they may not actually be aware of. Most of them would not think they would have some of this information. It's not geographies they deal with, yet this content is flowing. So we want to definitely cater to those users to bring those protections, but also to the more sophisticated organizations who have well-defined needs, who have compliance officers, compliance policies, and know what they want to protect from a very granular perspective. So really looking at two perspectives here, being both powerful for experts, but also easier for generalists. And we start off with the Office 365 Protection Center, which really brings DLP, but also other compliance features and security features to give you one window into how your organization's controls are effective and how you deploy those and how you monitor and how you get insights about those. We're also adding custom classification support. It's a capability we've had in the Exchange DLP for quite some time, and we're making that part of the Protection Center to allow this to be now used in SharePoint, OneDrive, and Exchange in a uniform fashion. This is one of the top asks from a lot of the larger organizations who have very specific needs of what they want to be able to protect, which aren't covered by the things we have built in. All right, so let's take a quick look in terms of what do some of the flows look like. And we'll start off with a simple configuration flow. So we have our happy admin who's configured their policies. Those policies flow into our policy store, a centralized location. And then based on the configuration of what locations you want to ship those are synced across SharePoint, OneDrive, Exchange. But we don't stop there. We keep going to the Office clients, Outlook, so you really have a consistent policy application no matter where you are and where that policy is occurring across both clients and server workloads. And as we add more capabilities, for example, things like Yammer, you would have exactly the same flow where that policy would be distributed into those stores to provide that uniform protection across Office 365. All right, so let's take a look at this from a different perspective, and now policy application. So now we've configured the policies, they're automatically distributed. We have users who are actually using the system, and we start off with our end users who are doing, who are working in their productivity apps, again, Outlook or SharePoint, and we provide those rich experiences right in those apps. And as you've seen from what AJ was showing, we're continuously expanding the set of applications where we have policy tips. And that's based on your feedback and based also on your usage pattern. As you use more of mobile apps, we're pushing policy tips into those experiences. So it's really the most important places where users are interacting. But we don't stop there, because once you've actually authored the content and ship it to the back end, we will reevaluate it again. And why do we do that? We do that so that if you're using one of the older clients, or maybe a platform we haven't enabled from a DLP policy, and in the client's perspective, we will reevaluate that so you have a consistent application of policy. Let's assume you're using still, Outlook 2010, where we don't have policy tips integrated. Well, guess what? Once that email is sent, the backend server will analyze it for policy violations and apply the same policies. For example, if it's block, it will send you an NDR. It won't be as rich of an experience from an end user perspective, but it will be still effective policy and consistent policy application. And then the last thing that we do here is we also store things in the audit and insight store for both our reporting story, but also for that rich insights capability we were showing you earlier. All right, so how do we actually go ahead and configure some of the more customized policy in the system? Well, so we have a policy authoring set of workflows that aid that. And again, these start from a very much a quick setup, easy to use wizards, but also are only a click away, or you're only a click away to be able to get into much more sophisticated controls where you can control every step of the policy definition. We have invested a lot in terms of simplifying the model so that, you know, only the most common options based on the usage we see are surfaced to our administrators to really deploy those quickly and get a lot of folks started. At the same time, we have a very rich policy framework underneath this, which is fundamentally based on a set of policy rules. So you can think of a policy as a container, and that container stores one or more rules that define how the policy functions. So the policy rules are, first of all, made of conditions, and the conditions basically describe the content and also the context of the operation. So who am I sharing it? Is it with a certain department? Is it sharing it internal or outside of the organization? And then, in addition to the conditions, we have a set of actions. And the actions basically say, well, when the conditions are true, this is the protection that should be applied. The actions really provide a gamut of different capabilities. Some of them are just simple auditing actions. But we also have remediation actions, where you can go ahead and actually block the sharing, or maybe actually change the permissions on the document in SharePoint to confine it to a specific user so that document is no longer in violation of the policy. And this notion of actions is actually generalized across the various workloads we integrate with, because blocking a document in mail is very different than blocking in SharePoint. But the generic capabilities here allow you to express the intent of your business policies, of your protection policies, in a uniform fashion, and then we do the job of actually mapping that of what is natural within each workload. So what is natural? How do you block a document in SharePoint? Well, we would actually change the permissions or prevent the upload of that content, or versus in email, you actually send an NDR as part of that same kind of configuration. All right, so now let's talk about content analysis. So this is kind of our classification engine, and it's really at the heart of the DLP solution. We actually have a second session today that will really focus on the content analysis engine and walk through the various configurations and flexibilities of what you can do as part of it. But the classification engine is actually something that we've had for quite some time, and its sophistication continues to expand as we continue to invest in making that be deeper in terms of the kinds of detections we can accommodate. So, you know, I'm not going to go through all of these in terms of the various matching techniques. You know, obviously combination of regexes, heuristics on top of that. We have a lot of internal functions that do checksum calculations, special date functions, MOVEN keywords. We're also investing in terms of things like unique matching, logical grouping of sensitive types to provide even more specific targeting of sensitive information. And we're also adding custom sensitive types. And as you can see here, the user here has created some sensitive types of their own. They've imported them into the system. And from then on, those sensitive types are usable and behave like any of the built-in types. You can leverage them in any of the policies you already have. You will have policy tips and all the IW experiences. It's really, at that point, they are part of the system. So in addition to the rich detection capabilities, we also, again, want to help you get started quickly by providing default built-in classification capabilities. And specifically, we have over 80 built-in types from around the world. And we've had multiple waves of how we delivered these that really first started kind of covering North America and Europe. And then we went into parts of Asia, South America, Africa. And it's really driven by A, feedback we hear from you in terms of this is the types we need. And two, based on geographies that have other regulations or have actually defined types that are global in nature, because that's the only types that make sense for us to provide as Microsoft. And we're continuously tuning also for our accuracy. Because of a lot of the deployments that you're part of, you can think of by volume, we're becoming one of the largest DLP vendors from a scan perspective. Well, we also get feedback from you guys in terms of accuracy. It all gets fed in to make the built-in types better over time. All right, so deep content analysis process. Just quickly going through this to give you a little bit of a sense of one of the analysis process, and this is something simple for credit cards, which is we obviously start off with the content, and that content can either be text in an email, it could be an attached file, which has to be text converted, so if you have a PDF file, we will actually convert that into a text stream or a Word document or an Excel document. And we'll start doing a regex analysis. In this case, we're looking for a 16-digit number. Great, that's step two. But we're not done there. Credit cards have checksums, so we will actually go ahead and detect matching credit card checksums and rule out the other ones, all in the purpose of minimizing false positives. Next, we'll have corroborative evidence or additional evidence, if you think about it, and that's within the proximity of the actual content. We'll apply proximity algorithms to further filter out content that doesn't look like it's valid. Credit cards have checksums. Other things like SSN, for example, don't have a strong binding capability across all the different formats. So things like additional evidence is very powerful. And at that point, we'll come with a verdict in terms of it being the sensitive type we think it is or not. And all of this is to build higher confidence and minimize false positives for your end users. And you can see the results of this in the Excel slides on the far right, or left, depending on who you are. So in that specific example, the data looks very similar, but the difference is the checksum's not matching, and we will detect some as credit cards, and the sheet underneath is not detected as credit cards because the checksums didn't match. All right, so custom sensitive types. We talked about this a little bit, but I wanted to highlight it again because it has been such a requested capability from all of you. And specifically here, we are using the same engine we had in Exchange, the same engine we've also embedded into Office clients, Outlook, and other apps, which means any sensitive types you've written in Exchange is actually fully compatible with what is going to be available in the Security and Compliance Center. It also means we're looking at the deeper integration of our classification with SharePoint and OneDrive. Because if you think about it, that is a lot of data at rest. So if you have a lot of content that you've already stored in those repositories, and once you create new types, we want to be able to recrawl that content so we can re-identify content that you have already shared. And again, with integration of this in the Security and Compliance Center, you have one place to define this across all of your Office 365 and use them as needed. All right, the final slide before we go into more demos, talking a little bit about our extensibility story from a classification perspective, and the fact that we don't actually have to classify the content ourselves to make a verdict on it. Specifically, you may have content from Microsoft or even external partners that has been classified and tagged as having some form of sensitivity. We will actually be able to read that metadata and use that to make a decision in terms of the protection controls that should be applied. And this is really important because it means there is some content that's just very hard to automatically classify. Well, that's okay. And if you already have processes where you've identified content that's sensitive, maybe by placing it in special shares or specific SharePoint locations, well, we can leverage that information to provide a consistent policy application, a consistent set of policy controls across all your content. All right, so let's switch to the next demo. All right, so here we're going to just take a look at some of the things we've been talking about in terms of how to provide deeper and more customized controls. So I'm back in my protection center, in my security and compliance center. As you can see, this is a different tenant. It has recommendations that are a little bit different because they're specific to their needs and their to their data. But you know, as we start off here, if we go into classification, we can see sensitive information types. This is where we have the list of sensitive types that are built into the system, and there's over 80 of those. And if we look at these, you know, these will cover kind of cross-globe things. If we look at the publisher, we can see that, well, you know what, this tenant actually imported some of their own types, and once they're imported, they're visible and used in exactly the same fashion you'd use any of the built-in types. So let's go back to our DLP dashboard. And here we see we have two policies. Let's go ahead and try to create another one and just show you the simple process. So you start off with having a set of protection templates. And these are really global in nature, really focusing on three areas of financial, medical, and privacy. And again, it's to just make some of these things easier in terms of giving you a starting point of how you configure the system. You know, and if you look in the financial, you know, there's stuff around the world. And these are other groupings or potentially regulations that we have mapped to make this easier for you to use. The medical and you know, various privacy templates as well. So go ahead and pick one of the financial, or we can pick one of the privacy maybe. Let's see. This person. So we'll pick USPII. This looks for passport numbers, ITIN, SSN numbers. We'll go ahead to next. Just provide some information in terms of name description. We'll go with the defaults. And now you get to decide where do you want to apply the policy. If we select, if we can apply to all of this, but we have full control to say, you know what, maybe this policy will be only applied to a specific SharePoint site. That SharePoint site is where HR stores their information, and we want to be able to target that with a specific policy. Or maybe, you know, we will exclude a certain, you know, set of, maybe it's only an email policy, because that is what we want to target. And you can actually include or exclude even specific sites in addition to just SharePoint on or off. Under policy settings, you start off with this kind of easy workflow that first identifies a set of conditions, in this case, the sensitive types. And then next, you know, you can obviously go ahead and add other types to customize this to your needs. And then decide, well, who am I targeting? Is this inside or outside the organization? And easily customize that. And if you go next, we will then start showing you the common options in terms of how to customize what happens when this rule is hit. So, you know, maybe on a few of these, we will just show you a policy tip. But you know what? If I detect more than five, I will actually start doing something a little bit more restrictive. Maybe I'll actually, you know, provide the policy tip with but require an override. Or maybe I'll, you know, send an email alert and a notification in more real time. These are all options that are common that you can use to build your policy rules that then represent your compliance policies. But you know what? Maybe we're actually going to even go further because I want to have more customizations. So there's this place, this is where you go and actually get into more of an advanced rule editor, where each one of these is represented as a specific rule. If I go ahead and edit these, this is where you really get deep in to see what are all the conditions and what are all the actions. And you know what? I'm actually going to jump out of here and pick one that's a little bit more interesting. So I'm going to go ahead and create another policy. But you know what? We're going to go to medical and click on HIPAA. Go exactly through the same process, apply to all, and go right into advance. And now if I go to HIPAA, and I go to edit rule, you're going to see something interesting where, you know, the first condition is about sensitive type. But as you can see, this is quite a complex condition, all being driven from the UX, where I'm actually have a set of groupings where I'm saying, you know what, we're going to look for one of these things, either a social security number or a common name, and any of these things, and only when all of those conditions are true will we consider a verdict. And this is a new capability we're adding this notion of being able to build compound rules to, again, target specific types of detections, which are common in HIPAA, but also in a lot of other scenarios. Going through the conditions, you can add other conditions in terms of where this is applied. You can start creating actions. And actions can be also very much tailored to the workload. If you look at SharePoint, we actually have options. This is a policy for both Exchange and SharePoint. But in SharePoint and OneDrive, we have specific options of what it does it mean to block. Do I just block it by removing external users? Or do I actually more lock it to specific individuals? Clearly, one allows collaboration to continue. One is more restrictive in terms of how it behaves. And then there's user notifications and alerting options that are available as part of this. All right. So we're going to end this here, and we're running pretty tight on time. So continuing this. So far we talked a lot about configurations, automatic recommendations, but a big part of usage of the system is being able to gain insights into reports and more of the operational nature of the system. And that's where we come in with insights and reports, where we've continued to invest more to provide an easier system for you to manage from an operational perspective. This is where, for example, we have now provided more reports and are building reports for things like incident level views in terms of providing you a view that allows you to see the full content of what has happened. We have reports that allow you to pivot on policies, rules, false positives. That's the data coming from end users. Who's overridden the policy? We also provide more proactive notifications to your administrators through things like alerts. And the alerts can be both DLP based, but that's also an area we're investing more broadly in the compliance, in the compliance features. And you can see there's a whole session tomorrow on alerting that shows you some of the areas we're getting into in terms of baseline deviation, insights-based reports, based on user or potentially even tenant activity. All right, so this is an example of an incident level view where we actually roll up the data to show you an aggregated view of, think of it as an item level view, either a document or a mail that represents a violation. And here you can see, what rules were hit, what sensitive information was found, and even the actual information types that actual data requires special permissions. And that's very, very much useful if you're doing false positive or even triaging the issue. Is this really a violation? Is this really a credit card number or an SSN, or is it something different? So I'm going to do a very quick demo of a part of on our alerting story. All right, so we're back in our tenant, and I've configured a policy where I, as Jack, as the admin here, I'm receiving alert notifications. This is an example of an alert notification for, where here a file was discovered containing sensitive information. I can go ahead and click investigate, and that brings me right into the protection into the Security and Compliance Center, where I can see the details of the alert. Up top you have some information in terms of the content, who performed the operation, but what's more interesting, as I scroll down, I can see a more holistic view of what policies were triggered. In this case, both my US API data and the DSS policy. In addition, I can see that what we found 10 credit cards and 2 credit card numbers and a specific confidence of what those numbers are. But more interesting, if I scroll further, I can actually see the sensitive content that was discovered. And this, again, is really important when you want to be able to quickly triage and determine, is this a false positive or something else? And we have both the type, the actual information, and then a little bit of context of where is that discovered. And then, as part of triaging this, you can do very simple operations like resolving this, closing, providing some comments as part of this. Anyway, I'm going to stop here and introduce BJ, who will actually be talking about some exciting work we're doing with partners in this space. There we go.
Okay.
PJ, all yours.
Thanks, Jack. So what you saw from Jack was some of the basic incident management functionality that we have available within the service itself. But we've also invested in making the underlying data available programmatically so that we can enable extensibility by third-party ISVs. And you'll see that there are some really, really rich scenarios that are possible. And so the way we make this data available is through the Office 365 Management Activity API. This is actually something we introduced at Ignite last year. Just a brief summary is that on the left, you've got the various workloads, whether it's OneDrive, SharePoint, Exchange. That's where the actual audit events are detected and logged. We route that through the unified auditing pipeline, and we put it in some long-term storage where we can use it within Office 365 itself, for example, what you just saw from Jack. But we also make that data available through the Management Activity API so that a third-party application could get it. Now, of course, that application can only get it if A, it requests permission to get it, and B, that organization's tenant admin consents to let that app have that data. If the tenant admin does not give that consent, then obviously no data would ever leave our data center. So with DLP, we just leveraged the existing API. But DLP events are a little bit special, so we had to do something to extend it a little bit. And there's two types of DLP events that we have. We have ones with non-sensitive data and ones with sensitive data. And as you saw already in some of Jack's demos, depending on the scenario, we'll actually show you the credit card number, or if it's some other custom type, we'll show you that number. But some customers, they don't want that data to be available. It is, after all, sensitive, so they want to further restrict it. So we have a DLP event just for the non-sensitive data, and that's where you're going to get the metadata about the event. What was the document or email that triggered it? What was the user? What was the policy and rule? What actions did we take it? Did we actually block it? Did we send out a notification to the admin? And what type of sensitive data did we detect? Those events are just ordinary events that are passed along in the existing audit feed. And so for those of you that know the Activity Feed API, you can subscribe to the audit.exchange content type, and you'd get all the auditable events for Exchange. Among them, you would get DLP events. Similarly for SharePoint, if you subscribe to that feed, that's where you're going to get all the SharePoint audit events, including DLP. And you can see that the permission required by the application is read activity data for an organization. Now, we also have these other events, the sensitive events, which are basically a superset of the non-sensitive. They contain all the non-sensitive data, but they now also contain the actual value of the sensitive data and that surrounding context to help give you information about how that data is being used. And this is available through a separate content type in the Activity API called DLP.all. And this requires its own permission as well, read DLP policy events, including sensitive data. And so this data would not be available to an application unless A, they request it, and B, the tenant agrees to give it to them. So just a real quick example, just to make this more concrete, this is what the data inside the feed look like. This is just a partial extraction of a single DLP event. And you see you get some of the metadata there. And in particular, that top blue field that I've labeled in blue, you see sensitive info detections is included. That's false. Here's the same event, but now in the sensitive data feed, the DLP.all. And now that sensitive info detections included is true, and you can see in the yellow, there are some new fields that are added. And that's where you put the actual value of the sensitive data and the context. And obviously, as I said, you need additional permissions. So what I'd like to do now is bring up some folks from BMC. We've been working with a third-party BMC. You may know them as the authors of Remedy. And they've built an integration with this API. And they're going to show you some very, very rich scenarios. So I've got Jeff DeRoche and Alex Henson. Cool. Thank you very much.
Thanks, BJ. My honor.
Can everybody hear me?
Let's keep.
Perfect. So hopefully some of you are familiar with BMC. We have a portfolio of tools we call our Digital Enterprise Management Suite. They do a number of things from monitoring system events, applications, hardware, through to deploying full stack servers in the cloud. But today we're going to focus on our IT service management tool. Some of you may be familiar with it. Show of hands if any of you used Remedy before. Some of you use it today, perhaps. Cool. If you don't use Remedy, you might be familiar with IT Service Management, or ITIL. Remedy is a service management tool. Service management, for those of you who are not aware, a set of best practices, processes, policies for helping you design, deliver, and manage IT, typically in large, complex environments. So when we think about service management today, Many of you will be familiar with ITIL. ITIL has been a great framework for many, many years, but it doesn't quite go far enough in the modern environment. So we look at these three drivers typically that shape the way we deal with service management. The first one on the far side, far left of the slide over there. Most organizations today are in the technology business. They maybe weren't 10 years ago, but today they definitely are. And when you're in the technology business, the ability for a startup to come along and disrupt your business is huge. Behemoth organizations that used to have monopolies on markets disappear overnight. So today, organizations have to be able to change not just quickly, but constantly. So we build service management tools to help organizations in this constant state of flux. And with that comes inherent compliance and security risks. The second big driver that's shaping service management is user experience. At the weekend in our personal lives, we use apps that make it really easy for us to book a cab, book a flight, book a hotel. But when people turn up to work on a Monday morning, it's like going back to the dark ages, and trying to get things done is very, very difficult. You typically send tickets to a service desk and they disappear into a black hole. So bringing that consumer-like experience to the enterprise is very, very important. And the third big driver for most companies is operational efficiency. Things like ITSM and ITIL for many, many years have been helping people to add consistency, do things in a complying way, an auditable way. But now we have to do that at massive pace and scale. Releases that used to take 2 or 3 months, people are now doing thousands of code drops a day. So how do we take all those best practices of service management and do it at pace and scale? So we typically see people we're trying to get them to the far side of the slide here, to service management excellence. That's everything that I talked about on the previous slide. How do you orchestrate and govern IT in a complex ecosystem? People typically do this in three stages, maybe not quite in this order. Modernizing the service desk is about bringing that consumable experience to IT, enabling people to interact with IT, enabling IT to interact with the business and solve things in a nice, easy, consumable way. Service awareness, which is about having deep insight into your IT, understanding the intricacies of your systems, your applications, your services, how they relate to each other, how they depend on each other, so you can make smarter decisions. And then service operations, which is the cool stuff. Once you've done the first two, you can then start to use extreme automation. So you can do things like when someone raises a change request, if you know the change, it's a common change, just go and automatically deploy it. Or if you get an event out of something like Office 365, enrich it, triage it, bring it into something like Remedy, give people the tools to be able to go and work it. That's exactly what we want to talk about today. Not just talk about, but show you as well, which is pretty cool. So you guys, by the way, are the first people ever to see this demo across the world, so very exciting time. So we do a few things. We pull DLP events into Remedy, so you can work them as a Remedy incident. We can do things like dynamically route them to resolvers, create service level agreements to help people resolve them in a sensible time. Use all the best practices of ITIL and IT service management to help work those incidents. And then use things like analytics and correlation techniques to help you decide how you're going to go and improve your compliance policies, or how you can go and prevent these things happening in the first place. So with that, I'm going to stop talking to my slides, and we're going to show you. So this is what you're seeing here is Remedy 9. If you've seen an old version of Remedy, this probably looks a little bit different. This is the new version of Remedy. Everything that we're about to show you, we're going to show you from a web browser. You can just as easily do this from a mobile device, a smartphone, or a tablet. So if I'm working on a service desk or I'm part of the compliance team, what I see here is my entry points, is my dashboard. I can see a number of incidents that are open. These are all compliance incidents here, and I can see whether we've got critical, high, medium, low priority incidents. On the left-hand side, you'll notice that we've got a DLP event that's been triggered by an exchange message. So we're going to dive straight into this, and we'll show you what a DLP event looks like inside of Remedy. You'll notice there's a lot of information here. So as we pull in the event, we're using the data from the DLP API to automatically enrich the ticket. We'll come back to this in a second, but at the bottom here, you can actually see we've attached the DLP event to the incident. So if I'm part of the compliance team and I want to go and resolve this, I want to do some investigation on it, I've got all the context. If you scroll down, we can see we've got the event source, we can see who triggered it, the policy and rule that was breached. We can even drill down if we want to and see the sensitive data in there.
And so, Jeff, this is Alex, rather, excuse me. This is the data that you actually got from the Activity API, right?
Right. all of this is coming from the DLP API. And in this context, you can see all the data.
As we were talking about earlier, you can mask this as well. And typically what you do is use role-based permissions inside of Remedy. So not everybody can see all the sensitive data.
And what if, for example, an organization doesn't want to give you their sensitive data? Can you still work with that?
Yeah, you can. So you can do it three ways. The first two are quite all or nothing and rudimentary. You can control it at the API level, so you can prevent data coming into Remedy. You could do it at the Remedy level. So we could say the API is trying to send me the data, but I don't want to receive it. Or you can do the more granular role-based permissions model and say, I want to receive all the data, but I only want to allow certain people to access it. So if we go back into the incident, first thing that you'll notice is that if you scroll down a little bit here, we can see that this has automatically been assigned at the bottom of the screen there in the corner. You'll see that it's gone to Bob Baxter. Based on the type of breach, the priority, the urgency, we've decided who's the best person or the best support group to go and work on this. In this instance, we're going to click the Assign to Me button because we're going to try and work through this incident and do something with it. First thing we might do is change the status of it. An ITIL best practice, we'll change it to in progress. This means if anybody else comes along, they know this ticket is being worked. You can see the red bar here. When this event was created a few hours ago, an SLA, a service level agreement, was assigned to it. This means that, again, depending on the type of breach, depending on the policies, we may want to resolve it in 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, whatever's appropriate. We might want to edit this. So at the moment, you can see in the green box there, this is indicated as low priority. If I've done my research, I've looked at the policy breaches, I may want to say, actually, this is higher priority for me. Let's put some more urgency on it. I can do things like favorite this incident. At the moment, because it's assigned to me, I get all the updates. If I reassign it to someone else, but I want to stay in touch with what's happening, I simply use the star here, and I can follow it. So there's a lot of information here. All of this automatically populated from the DLP API, enough information for me to go and start work on it. Maybe what I want to do is work with some colleagues in my team. I might not really understand too much about this particular policy breach. So from within Remedy, I can go and send an email, and we'll attach some information about that DLP event.
So Alex, as a recipient of this email, what will I actually get?
So you'll get an email in your inbox. It will have a snapshot of the incident information, enough for you to have a clue what we're talking about. You'll be able to respond directly to that email. If you do, we'll consume the content of that email directly in Remedy, and it will be tracked as part of the incident. If they've got a login to Remedy, they could even dive straight into the ticket and start working it as well.
Great.
So you can actually see on the right-hand side here in the activity feed, this is where we're tracking everything that we do to go and resolve this incident. So we have a full audit trail of the steps that we've taken. You can see we've changed the priority, that we've sent an email to Alan. If he responds, that's going to happen straight on this right-hand side as well. What Jeff's doing now is he's showing you that you don't have to email people if you don't want. You don't have to clog up people's email inboxes. We have social collaboration tools in here. You reference people the same way you would on Twitter or Facebook, and you can start having a conversation with your team. So we've started to look into this ticket a little bit. We've started to get some help from our teams. But one of the key things that we do in service management is we use what we call knowledge articles. So if we click into the resources, Jeff, what Remedy's doing here is it's looking at the incident, it's looking at the data, it's looking at the context, and it's saying, based on what you've got in this incident, we think there are some knowledge articles that can help you solve this, that can help you go and have a conversation with the offender.
So how do those knowledge articles get created, and who does that?
Typically, you would have subject matter experts in an organization who are specialized in commonly occurring breaches, and you'll get them to create these knowledge articles. The best practice in a support organization is that when you work on an incident, you assign a knowledge article to it. If you can't find one that's relevant, you create one. So you have this continual process of evolving the knowledge and sharing it. So in this case, we can see Remedy suggesting a knowledge article. I can see that it's got 100% rating. It's got a number of views. So it's probably quite relevant to me. If I go in there, it then gives me these steps to follow. So I can call up the person that's perhaps breached the DLP policy. I can take them through the steps. It's even got a video in here. So if I need to walk him through some basic compliance training, I've got all that content to send off to him. If the article isn't relevant, I can comment on it, I can flag it, the author gets a note to say you need to update this or evolve it. We obviously have admin rights, so we can go and edit it ourselves. But in this case, let's assume we've had a conversation with the person who's breached the policy, and we'll go and click Save and Resolve.
And so what actually happens to the incident in that case where you save and resolve?
So in this case, what we've done is, if you can see on the knowledge article, there's a green pin. So we've linked that knowledge article to this incident. We've also, in the top left, next to the service level agreement bar, we can see that the status has changed to resolved. So we've resolved it, and we've indicated that we've resolved it by following this knowledge article. Now, you could do something different. So you could pin the knowledge article but not change the status to resolved if you want to carry on working it, or you could simply X out and say this knowledge article is not relevant, in which case the author would get a note to say that it's it needs some work.
So I have a question. What if I have several incidents that I think are related? Does Remedy help me manage that scenario?
Yes, it does. So under the knowledge articles, you can see it's also saying that we've got lots of recommended tickets. Essentially what it's saying is that based on the ticket you're working on, we found other tickets that look and feel pretty similar. So in the world of service management, what we do is go and create a problem investigation. So again, we can do this in the bottom. We create a related item, and we're going to go and create a problem investigation. Now, problem investigation is a bit different. With an incident, that's really about tactically resolving something now. For a problem investigation, it's about trying to identify root causes for commonly occurring patterns or correlations. So this looks pretty much like the previous screen. To the uninitiated, it might look the same. What we've done when we create the problem investigation is we've pulled over all the information, all the DLP information from the incident. We can assign it to a problem coordinator or have it automatically assigned. And what we're going to do here is go and search for some DLP incidents in the system that have the same search terms. So we could look for DLP. We'll see there are some similar items. And we can relate them to this problem investigation. What then happens is whoever this ticket gets routed to, it could be Mr. Compliance Coordinator there or someone with an extra level of expertise, they'll have all of this information, all of these related tickets. They can pick it up on their mobile device, they can pick it up on their web browser, and then go and start to work on what the root cause is.
So you give like a top-down view of the environment for the compliance officer of what's going on in my organization, where do I get that?
Yes, so if we go over to reporting, this is smart reporting in Remedy. We use this right across the Remedy platform, and we have our data compliance dashboard. So again, this, what we're doing here is combining information from the DLP API, the incidents, and we get a couple of different sort of types of information here. So here we can see at the top here we've got a false positives chart. So we can see that for this particular rule, we've got a disproportionate number of false positives. Maybe we want to go and look into that. We can see we've got some repeat offenders. Our friend Jeff over here is obviously our favorite DLP offender. We can see what policies and rules are being breached. So that's sort of the DLP level view. It might trigger us to go and implement some education or compliance training. At the bottom, what we've got is our operational level view. So I can look into my team, the people working on the service desk, and I can see how many incidents open, how many have been resolved, how many are in progress, what's the criticality of them. So it enables me to make more team-based decisions on how we're performing, whether I need to get extra help. And at the bottom, we can actually see our incident submission trend. So we can see in the last few weeks, we've got a few spikes, an inordinate number of DLP events coming in. Gives us cause to go and investigate that.
Looks pretty comprehensive.
Cool, thank you. In summary, we pull the DLP data straight from the API. We enrich it, we turn it into an incident. You can then work it using traditional service management techniques. We allow you to collaborate with teams, the other people in your organization, create problem investigations. You can actually, if you really wanted to, go and trigger actions as a result of the incident. So if you want to go and block someone's user account, you can trigger that as an action from within Remedy. And for the compliance officers here, we give them this sort of top-down view of the world.
And if I'm, for the folks in the audience who are saying, how do I get it? What's the answer? How and when?
So officially, I have to say it's in the 6-month time frame. I can tell you it's much sooner. It's in the next few weeks. As I say, you're the first people to really see this. But we have a Remedy release coming out very, very soon where you'll be able to access this. So if you're a Remedy customer, go and speak to your admin. If you're not, go and have a look on bmc.com/remedy, and you'll see this information appearing on there in the next few weeks.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So what I'd like to do now is bring back up AJ, who's going to talk to you about our roadmap.
Okay, so we've shown you a lot of things today. Some of the things are relatively new, but one thing we haven't gotten into is dates. So we thought we'd spend a few minutes of giving you a little bit of idea of when things are actually coming. But before I jump into it, let me give you a little bit of a view of what we've done in the past 12 months. We've had a lot of innovation in the DLP solution. And if we go back to September of last year, so we actually brought the DLP policy tips into the desktop Word, Excel, and PowerPoint versions in Office 2016. And then November of last year, we actually added DLP for SharePoint and OneDrive for Business, or SharePoint Online and OneDrive for Business. Obviously, after the holidays, we all came back, did a lot more work, and we added additional things like DLP override reporting, policy tips inside of OneDrive mobile on Android, and we also brought DLP into the on-prem SharePoint product for SharePoint 2016. We also, of course, added additional built-in types in February of this year, and then we've continued to add in additional policy add in support for policy types across many of the mobile applications for OneDrive, so be it on iOS or the universal app for Windows. And then we've also brought in the Exchange Unified, or Exchange into the Unified DLP screens that you saw today. So you saw where Jack was showing you that you could do Exchange, SharePoint, and OneDrive through one policy. So we brought that into preview as of May of this year. And then last but not least, I'll say is in July of this year, we made some improvements to the DLP timer job. So Jack didn't get into the full details of actually how the DLP policy actually kicks in. But effectively under SharePoint, the way that it works is that we use the indexer to actually index content, and then we have a timer job that actually goes and checks that index to make sure if there's any content in there that violates DLP policy. So we've done some work to actually improve the latency of that job. All right, so what's the roadmap? So in 2016, we plan on releasing a lot more of the functionality that you just saw. So like the automatic DLP policies for new tenants, we hope our goal is to release that this year. The user-driven recommendations that Jack showed you, the simplified admin experience, the dictionary and unique matching classification pieces we're working on, the binary operator, so the and or thing that Jack showed you in some of the screenshots, where you could say if this thing happens and or this thing happens, then go ahead and trigger that policy. The stuff that we just showed you with the sensitive data inside the API, the custom sensitive type. So if you want to write your own custom sensitive type, is maybe have a medical record number that you actually want to put in that's unique to your organization, we want to have that brought in. We want to have you recrawl. So again, if you create a new policy and you want to scan all the content that you have in SharePoint Online and OneDrive, you should be able to do that. Built-in HIPAA policies, and then additional reporting and insight, and of course, bringing policy tips when sharing content in OneDrive and SharePoint. Now, there's some stuff that we know we need to work on. We can't commit that it's going to happen this year. So this is the, quote, the beyond bucket. The things that we know, like, okay, we've heard feedback from many of you that said, hey, we need you to do more in some spaces. Places like, we need richer DLP capabilities in the desktop clients. Give me policy tips in more locations. Come on, give me that place where my users will see that information. The sensitive type authoring and tuning from a user experience perspective. A lot of this stuff will be done early on from a PowerShell perspective. But we want to bring it into a very familiar and easy-to-use UI. File-level IRM in OneDrive and SharePoint for DLP content. So if you have content that's considered sensitive and you want to encrypt it using our IRM technology, we know it's something that, again, people have been asking for. And the last but not least is bring it to additional workloads. We've been talking a lot about SharePoint, OneDrive, and Exchange today. But we've heard from many customers loud and clear that we want the same content protection in Yammer and Skype for Business. So those are the things that are kind of on the roadmap of, we know we need to get to them, but we can't commit to dates at this point in time. All right. So at a very high level, I think we've kind of shown you a lot for DLP today, how we focus on detection, protection, and monitoring. So that detection, we showed you very easily how you can create policies that can find your sensitive content wherever it lies in Exchange, SharePoint, and OneDrive. On the protection side, help you show that you can stop that accidental sharing and educate those users through those policy tips. And last but not least, that monitoring. Give you the great reporting so that you can look at that and see how your policies are performing and then fine-tune them as appropriate to get the results that you're looking for. So if you had other sessions to go to around DLP, I'd highly recommend the one that's later on this afternoon, which is Customize and Tune, the Microsoft Office 365 DLP. But we also have additional sessions around auditing and investigating alerts. And then there's a general overview around a lot of the information protections solutions that we have within Office 365. And of course, if you want to get started with many of the Office 365 features and get going, we highly recommend that you take a look at FastTrack, which is a service that we provide. And then, of course, we highly recommend you join the Microsoft Tech community to collaborate, share, and learn from other experts. And that's it. So we'll go ahead and take Q&A, but again, we love feedback. Tell us if we're good, bad, how we could be better. So please feel free to do the evals. And with that, we'll jump into Q&A. So I'll ask the Microsoft speakers to come on back up. If you have any questions, walk up to a microphone, and we're happy to answer them. Thank you.
I have a question.
Gentleman down here.
Yeah, I have a question on the email delivery. So when you detect a DLP compliant email, let's say you detect a credit card information, what are the custom options do we have for delivery? Can we enforce TLS for if we detect a credit card instead of just blocking it?
So make sure I can hear the question correctly. Effectively, you're saying what are the other options that we have outside of just blocking the email being sent
right.
if something gets triggered from a DLP perspective in email. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah.
So Jag or BJ, you want to help answer this one?
Sure.
I know there's a lot that we can do with obviously transport rules and stuff, but.
Yeah, so we actually have a lot of richness in Exchange in terms of the kind of actions you can take. So encryption is very much a part of that. We have actually multiple types of encryption. You can do IRM encryption. There's Office 365 message encryption, which is based on IRM technology, but a little bit easier to consume on various devices. There's actually been talks around encryption in a conference that you can see of how those two things would come together. Then you can also put things in quarantine. You can do moderation in terms of somebody doing an approval for, before that message is released and continued on.
Right. How about TLS? Can we enforce TLS?
So you could enforce TLS. That will give you to the next hop TLS enforcement.
Right.
But that's from a transport perspective, that is possible to set that up as well.
Okay. And you said DLP is also checking the attachments.
Yes.
What about compressed attachments?
Yeah, so we do have support for various zip formats or compressed files where we will actually crack those and open them and look at various attachments. If you go to TechNet, there's an article that describes how deep we go, what are the file formats we support, and all the details that probably would be that you're probably looking for.
Cool, thank you.
Question over here.
Hi. Currently, we are using Semantic Cloud for our DLP solution, and we have created nearly 100 policies. What is the best way to transfer all those policies to Office 365?
So I don't believe there's a direct conversion that we have that says, hey, you can take your DLP policies from another product and port them directly in. It'd be more of a, I don't know if it's a pure manual process, but it's just definitely some work that would have to be done.
It sounds like a great opportunity for some of the entrepreneurs in the room to provide a solution, but we don't have anything ourselves that we actually do the automatic conversion. So it's a manual process right now of actually how to do that from both either creating custom types or using our built-in type and customizing those to match the capability. I mean, it's a request we've seen not the first time, but not a tool that we, Microsoft, have. I don't know if there's actually tools from other partners or vendors that do this kind of work.
Thank you.
Question over
here. Is there any solution for using this technology with on-premise file shares?
So the DLP solution that we have only works in those three workloads we talked about, which is Exchange, SharePoint, and OneDrive. We don't do on-prem file shares or anything that's on-prem. It's only within those three services, or three workloads in the service.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One of the largest challenges I had with rolling out DLP in my environment were the false positives. You have any suggestions for deal with that?
Yeah, so we'll actually, the session that AJ referred to, the one at 3 o'clock, will actually be very much about tuning and creating custom types. DLP is only as good as the types that you're actually detecting. So if your type is very loose, let's say something like a driver's license where the definition could be anything, it's hard to make the technology actually detect something that's so loose versus if you're looking for something like a credit card or some of the national IDs that have checksums, you can lower your false positives because there's more data to look for. We'll be covering a set of tools that are available in the product to actually help you with this, but it really depends on the type and the kind of data you have. We have reporting, we have alerts, various things you can use in your processes of tuning and then potentially customizing the types to remove those. You know, happy to talk to you afterwards if you have specific types, if this is, you know, more custom versus not, to get more insights. We always want to hear from you guys in terms of false positives or how you're dealing with detections, because that really helps us. We don't have the world of credit card numbers in our systems, so obviously that kind of information is hard to come by.
I'm not so much concerned with missing some of the data, because I know it's not possible to stop all of it, but there are instances where, like, for example, when Remedy generates a ticket, its ticket number is going to look like a driver's license number in some states. And those examples just go on and on forever. And in a large organization, that can generate a tremendous workload to deal with the false positives.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, what you're targeting and how you're potentially tuning it. I mean, you know, if you had something like a conflict with Remedy numbers, there's probably easy ways to take those out, because those probably have a format that's well understood. But that's specific to the environment where you're actually deploying it and the types you're looking for.
Okay, thanks.
All right,
question here.
Are there ways to protect from data loss through detachable devices, storage devices like thumb drives and things like that?
So from our solution perspective, again, we only focus on those three workloads. There's nothing that we do for like a USB drive or anything else that says, I mean, once the data's on the device, we don't stop the actual copy of the data. There are solutions within Windows that can say you can't copy data down to a USB drive. You can like lock those out. But there's nothing in the 365 service that we say you can't copy this information to a USB stick.
Now, what I'll add to what AJ said is you could have an indirect solution where, kind of to what the gentleman was asking earlier, where for the various sensitive types, you would actually automatically apply things like RMS protection on top of that. And then those documents are locked, so even if they're taken to those USB devices, you have the protection traveling with them. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit different scenario you're talking about, but that's one area where you can tie those two things together to make sure that the documents that are truly sensitive have the protection that travels with them and are locked no matter where they go.
And what if the sensitive information is in some kind of a scanned image or something like that, you know, not PDF, but...
We support numerous file formats. Mm-hmm. We don't do text recognition today, so we don't convert from images into text and apply capabilities on that. I'd love to hear feedback from you or others in terms of how you see that. We've seen a little bit of interest in that, but not much to push that high in our priority list at this point.
Okay.
Question here.
That was part of my question about we see a lot of documents in our organization that we had the forms for them, and usually we print them out for the higher management to sign them and other companies to sign them as well, right? And when we scan them and upload to our SharePoint, they are not classified as confidential or whatever, right? So it's because of the, probably we don't do any kind of OCR.
Correct, so we don't do, do OCR, which is basically optical character recognition, converting those images into text streams. It is an area we've, as I said, it's an area we've kind of explored a little bit. It's if there's more feedback from you guys, this is kind of how we determine some of our priorities of what that is. But it's not a very common ask, although we hear it sometimes.
But we do support things like PDF and other.
Correct. Yes.
It's just not images, so like JPEGs or things like that.
Yeah, and TechNet has a whole list, similar to when we talked about the archives, of which types we support. Obviously, our solution extends beyond just Office documents in terms of being able to convert them. And when I talked about how classification works, the first step of that is taking it from some native format and creating a text stream out of that. So if you have a PDF or a Word document or an Excel sheet, those become the same kind of streams that we can analyze as part of it.
Okay. And I have another question is, when we tried to implement DLP some time ago, we noticed that it was different. We had to go to different places to implement to SharePoint, OneDrive, and to Exchange Online, right?
Yes.
I noticed on the presentation, you were able to show one place to do both of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when are you going to be able to do that?
So the unified piece, so the stuff that you saw today that Jack showed was in that roadmap of it's coming this calendar year is what we're aiming to actually release it in. So in the next few months, you should be able to see that.